you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining us once again is our pal and fellow podcaster and fellow comics nerd, Kyle Benning. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me aboard.
It's great to have you back. It's been a really long time since we recorded anything together, and the last time was an episode of Treasury Cast. So I'm happy to be talking with you again, especially for this book, this very unique book, Whammo Giant Comics. Why don't you, Kyle, explain to people a little bit what Whammo Giant Comics even is?
Yeah, this is a crazy one here. It's, I hope, still the largest comic book ever made. Over 1,500 action panels. It is roughly 21 inches by 14 inches. So if you've been picking up like the Marvel, like king size hardcovers, where they have like the Kirby is Mighty or Ditko is Strange, those giant hardcovers, this is the exact same size as that. Except under a cardboard cardstock cover here. And it printed in glorious 1967 four color awesomeness.
Yeah, it's not quite as durable as those Marvel Kirby editions they've been putting out. Yeah, this book, I never knew this thing existed until years ago when I was working on my Treasury Comics website. And I saw that Whammo in 1967 decided, like everyone else, to get in on the Batman craze. And they were like, oh, hey, anybody can do a comic. So Whammo decided to put all of their efforts into just, again, not just a regular comic, but as Kyle just said, the biggest comic ever done, 14 by 22, features something like, I don't know, like 30 or 40 different strips. And we'll talk about the wiseness of that decision. Wisdom of that decision to put that many strips in a comic book like this. Because of its sheer size, it is not something you see hardly ever anywhere because it's impossible to store. It's just impossible to store. And again, as Kyle just talked about, those Marvel editions, those are hardcovers. So you can put them on a shelf if you have a big enough shelf and they stay up. But this thing, it's basically put together by Staples. So it's not the most durable thing in the world. Where do you store yours, Kyle?
So I actually have a old cabinet it's my dresser as a kid that I've refinished, and I have that in our bedroom now, and I have some comics in that. And so it has like this big open cabinet section that I've taken some shelves out, and that's where I keep all those king size hardcovers in. And I just slide this in between a couple of those to keep it upright. So
smart.
Before I pulled it out to prepare for this one, it was in between the first one they did, which was the Galactus one. And then the Kirby is Fantastic hardcovers. Right. So that's where I keep it sandwiched between those two.
Makes total sense. I have a bookshelf with all my treasuries on it, and it's butting up against another bookshelf, and there's a slight space between the two, and I just store it in there. That keeps it upright. Still, it still tends to fall over a little bit. Again, that's part of the reason of that this thing is sort of relatively unknown, and it's not really collectible because it is so hard to find. Now, you found yours on eBay fairly recently, right? You got a not a bad deal on it.
Yeah, I got mine for about $40, I think, probably.
That's a really good price. That
6 or 8 months ago. Yeah, I checked last night, and I think there was one on there for about $80, and then all the rest were for $100. I think there's one that I saw.
For a 50-year-old comic that's impossible to store and ship, that's actually surprisingly cheap.
Yeah, and I saw one that was listed for $750. So.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well, good luck selling that, dude. This book is – again, Whammo, I think – decided, again, the idea I think behind this was to appeal to everybody. And as we're going to go through all of the strips that are contained in this comic, you'll see that they were shotgunning it. because there are strips for everybody. There's superheroes, there's sci-fi, there's, you know, sort of horror, there's kind of boys' life, there's adventure strips, there's comedy, there's like featurettes. It's everything. And actually, considering that it's a, you know, squarely an American release, it feels kind of European in that way to me, in that it has lots of different kinds of things. It's those, you know, when you would get those European imports sometimes over in America, and you would see they would stick like a Superman in with like a House of Mystery, and then like a Young Romance all in one book. And you're like, what is this? And it's like, I think kids in other countries were more used to different genres as opposed to America, where it's all superheroes, all horror, all whatever. But so Whammo has that feel because it is just all over the place. All the styles are different. It really is just like a very, very strange release. And there's other fun things that we're going to discuss when we're talking about this book. The cover is by an artist named W.T. Vinson, who I am relatively unfamiliar with. His style looks a little Jack Davis-ish to me. It's not exactly, but it's this massive cover where you see all the characters, virtually every character that appears in this book is here in just one giant group shot. And you'll be able to see some of these images on the website, findwaterpodcast.com. And it's just a giant group shot. It has a very, it's a mad world kind of feel. It says Whammo Giant Comics and giant lettering. It is funny that it's approved by the Comics Code Authority, which was funny that they actually bothered to submit this. The cover price was a whole 98 cents. You have to remember, you know, and when this came out in 1967, comics were what, 12, still 12 cents for the most part. So that was a full six times what a normal comic cost. But again, you realize you're getting a lot. Surprisingly, Whammo put a lot of money behind this, and that this book was supported by a TV ad campaign, apparently in at least California, which is shocking to me. They actually spent the money to book television commercials. One television commercial promoting this comic, and you will hear the audio from that commercial at the end of this episode. I couldn't believe that commercial existed, but it's on YouTube, and it's the shot of all these kids running to a like a box, like a display box, where they can get their copy of Whammo. And man, would I not kill to have that Whammo display box?
Yeah, who knows? Maybe some of the listeners out there will have that little piece of a trivia on their shelf. I don't know. Surely there's at least one box out there still in existence. So
I sure hope so. Yeah,
maybe someone has a hold of it.
I would love it. I mean, DC did those too in the 70s, Treasury display boxes. And I've never been able to find one of those, but I hope springs eternal that someday somebody's going to put it up on eBay for a price that I can get. So, all right. So, Kyle, what do you think of this cover? I mean, it's really just a group shot. Everybody's just sort of standing around, really. Nobody's doing much. But what do you think of it and by the way, it is a wraparound cover. I should mention all the other characters are up on the back, and there's a balloons. It says adventure, science fiction, mystery, fun cartoons. And I can't get my head around how long it must have taken Mr. Vincent to draw an ink, to pencil and ink this. This is a massive undertaking.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder at what size he drew it. If he just drew it at this, one for one size, or if it was blown up, you know, another two-fold or whatever, that would have been a giant piece of art.
Imagine? But, yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, I love the art. Yeah. What, hundreds or thousands of characters jammed in here. He does a pretty good job of aping a lot of the styles, but yet still making it look uniform. So a lot of the characters look pretty much right on model for what they look like in their individual strips inside, yet there is still kind of a cohesive feel to it, too, where you can tell those are all by one artist.
Yeah.
I do wonder if the Steel Skull, it looks like he actually appears on the front cover twice.
Oh, does he really? I never noticed that.
So he's in front of like the space gorilla.
Yeah.
There. And then if you look, there's like a red truck amidst the crowd of people underneath the space between the M and the I on the front cover. And then there's another kind of, maybe it's just a general skeleton, but I don't remember any other strips having a general skeleton in there. So it looks like it's the Steel Skull's head in there again. So.
Well, I'm sure he had a massive checklist to work from, and he probably just forgot. You know, he's just like, "Did I draw that? All right, close enough. It's good. It's all right." But yeah, I can't imagine the undertaking this must have required. Like, oh my God. So on the inside, what we're going to do is we're kind of going to just trip hammer through these strips. We're going to have commentary on some of them more than others, obviously. I will try and go through this sort of as briskly as possible because there is so much to talk about. And by the way, I have the comic out as I am recording this, and I'm trying to go through it. I have my list here on my computer, but I'm also just trying to turn the pages, which is hard because my desk is only so big. So the comic, currently, the comic is spilling over off of my desk onto my cat's apartment as she starts to trying to climb on this thing. I mean, that's how big this comic is. There's no real way to look at it other than on the floor. As a kid, I can't imagine how else you would, maybe a table, but other than that, you can't even really hold it comfortably. It's something you have to kind of lay flat and just hold it because it is just so absurdly huge. As I'm talking, my cat is crawling on it as we speak. So okay, the first couple of strips, the first one, they knew, Wham-O knew to lead off with a strong one. Radian, which is a kind of Magnus robot fighters like Thunder Agent type strip by Wally Wood. And it's 3 pages long, and it's full of Wally Wood-esque adventure. You know, it's Wally Wood in the 60s. I mean, Wally Wood, one of the greatest guys ever to do it. Radian as a character is pretty generic in terms of, you know, how he is as a superhero. But, I mean, it's solid superhero adventure. And, again, drawn by Wally Wood, you can't beat it. So, again, Wham-O knew to kind of start in a strong place. I am curious about how many panels Wham-O seemed to insist on any given page, because like on page 2 of this comic, I mean, there's what, I think 30 panels?
That's,
I don't know why they decided to kind of make it, why not let them breathe a little when you've got this kind of space?
Yeah, it really is. It's more like a 10 to 12 page story jammed into 3 pages. I did count. It's 91 total panels across the 3 pages.
Oh my lord.
So you got 30, 31, and 30. Not to mention, and that doesn't include, there's a few kind of in the gutters between panels, some narration pieces there, which was a nice, clever use of some exposition and everything. So,
I mean, even just having to rule out 90 panels takes forever. Just having to get your ink pen and your ruler and map that out, that takes a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. The giant format does allow for some interesting storytelling concepts that you wouldn't be able to get in a, you know, normal size comic, or probably even in a normal size treasury, but it would be nice to really open it up and maybe have given Wally 6 pages, cut down on the panel counts and really let him use the size to his advantage to have some bigger, more epic or cinematic panels, really let the art breathe. But you know, that said, he's still a master. It is still awesome to look at. I mean, you still do get some panels, like the top of the first panel on page 3 there. I mean, it's a taller panel that would take up, what, 2/3 or most of a single comic page normally.
Yeah.
So you still do get some larger panels to let it breathe here. But this was because it's Wally Wood, and this was really my draw that triggered me to try to go out and find this one anyway. So it's certainly a strong strip to start with. And I love the tagline. I'm sad that we didn't get more of this Radian, the Atomic Hercules. So.
Yeah, it's a big, strong guy punching robots, which outside of nudity was Wally Wood's favorite thing to draw. So, it's a great – and his name is the name most associated with Wham-O Comics, I think, because he was by far the biggest name attached to it. So when you type in Wham-O Comics on Google, whoever does, that's the name that you tend to come up the most, because that's the name people have heard of. So that's the strip. As far as I know, Radian has never appeared again. This is like a one-off. I'm guessing Wham-O owns all these characters to this day. I don't know what their deals were. So okay, there's a bunch of strips after that. There's Tor, which is not the Joe Kubert character, but a stone idol caveman come to life by Lou Fine. Lou Fine. I mean, you know, so the first two strips are by Wally Wood and Lou Fine. We are off to a good start here on Wham-O. That is followed by a strip called The Young Eagles, which is like a World War I pilots type strip by someone named Andre LeBlanc.
So Andre LeBlanc, he was actually he'd go on to be an instructor at the New York School of Visual Arts.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, excellent. Okay. You can tell he's a big plane guy, because there's a couple of shots of people, but it's mostly biplane action. That's really the main strip here, the main feature of this strip.
So I dug into him a little bit more. He was actually one of Will Eisner's assistants on the Spirit. And it looks like he also assisted both of the Barry brothers on their Phantom and Flash Gordon strips.
Wow, right.
And I believe he also did some work on the Rex Morgan strip and the Apartment 3G strip. And then he was also the illustrator on the 1979 Picture Bible.
Huh.
So while he might not be a real heavy hitter known in the world of comic books, he certainly had his hands in a lot of, I guess, bigger projects, and then would go on to be an instructor at the School of Visual Arts. So
all right.
He probably left his thumbprint on a lot of artists, I guess.
Probably. Good for him. All right. Next up is Experiment in Shock, which is just kind of a goofy monster strip. That has – the artist is someone named Stefanagan. I'm not familiar again with who that is. His style is kind of a very loose Jack Davis sort of thing, and it's just kind of like – silly monsters sort of thing. I enjoyed looking at it. The only problem is, and we're going to run into this a lot in this, is too much dialogue. Like, there are panels, and again, one page has like 35 panels. There are a giant, I mean, there are panels here that are two-thirds dialogue. And it's just like, it. Part of the problem with Wimmo, ironically, this being the biggest comic book ever printed, some of it's kind of hard to read because yep. there's so much dialogue between the characters.
Yeah, really, probably the strip that really utilized the real estate they were given the best was that Young Eagles one.
Yeah, that's strip, they're right. One. Yeah, it's mostly just the planes, yeah.
Yeah, really has some bigger panels, and you really get a chance to let the artwork breathe and stick in the detail here. Everything yep. else is, yeah, it's 10 to 12 pages crammed into three here. So,
I mean, I'm sure they wanted it to read like a Sunday comic strip. You know, like when you get the newspaper, that's kind of what they wanted. Is that's where you would read the whole thing in one go. I'm sure that's what they're trying to emulate here, but that's not what this is. This is a comic book. It just seems like a curious way to approach it.
Yeah, for sure. I did look up that Stefan Hagen. According to the Grand Comics database, they're attributing it to Bruce Stefan Hagen, and it looks like he has done some magazine comics in the 60s, like Hot Rod Cartoons magazine and stuff, where you can really see the similarity in style. Yeah, this really seemed to, like, he was trying to ape, like, an EC horror style, like you said, like a Jack Davis or like a Graham Ingalls type artwork. But it didn't have near the punch of of what those would. And so I kind of wonder, too, if that was some of the appeal to some of these artists that you don't really see any scripting or writing credits, that maybe it was a chance for these guys that are primarily artists to get a chance to kind of write some of their own work. And that could be why some of this is so wordy, too. They're not as polished on the writing side.
That could be. That's true. I never thought about that. But, yeah, you're right. Maybe they're just – this is their first shot, and they don't know. You don't need to have three paragraphs in a panel. You know, you can kind of cut things down a little, let the artwork tell the story. So then we have Mark of the Sun, which is about the adventures of an intrepid astronaut named Ray Starkey. That artist is by Mike Arends. We have another kind of mystery strip called The Unexplored, which is a half page that features aliens. And it has a kind of an EC-esque twist ending by Dennis Ellefson. I actually kind of liked Unexplored quite a bit because it's so brief. It's three rows of panels, and then they get out, which I actually liked. I liked a lot. I liked the shortness of it. There's Kaleidoscope of Fear, about a young boy named Jason Jones who meets aliens from the future, by Ernie Colon. Again, another heavy hitter here. I'm a big fan of Ernie Colon, so that's really fantastic. Again, we've got Wally Wood, Lou Fine, Ernie Colon. Again, they've really got some good people here.
Yeah, this one has awesome artwork. I knew this would be one of your favorites. I remembered that you were a big Ernie Colon fan. And yeah, this is a fun strip. And, I got thinking that Kaleidoscope's like, oh, surely Wham-O must have made one of those. And this is kind of like a backdoor promo thing. But then I looked, and when I did some Google searching for Wham-O Kaleidoscopes, all I could find were Kaleidoscope patterns on Wham-O Frisbees. So this wasn't as much of a commercial promo as I thought it was. But another one of those kind of interesting strips that I would have loved to see future installments of it that sadly we just never got.
It's funny you say that. I never really thought of it, but you're right. There on the cross, all these strips, there really is not a lot of like Wham-O promotional marketing. Like none of the characters are grabbing like a Frisbee or anything. They really could have, I could have seen them insist on that. I could have seen Wham-O saying, look, if we're going to hire you to do these two pages, you got to work in a Wham-O product of your choice. But they don't really do that. It's kind of other than the advertisers, which we'll get to, Wham-O itself isn't really appearing in a lot of these actual strips. So after this, there's Galaxo, the Cosmic Agent, about a heroic space alien by someone named Marvin Stein, which I found to be dull as dishwater. There's The Unhumans, about an alien race that attempts to take over Earth by duplicating people, with art by John Ushler. And then something called Stellar Apes, about alien batting space employers. Space Sports, complete with Maynard G. Krebs-style goatees, with art by Dennis Ellefson. Did any of these stick out to you?
No, I did like the Unhumans one. It was similar to the one with the kelp people. I mean, in both cases, we had duplicates, alien duplicates, taking the place of people. So Mark of the Sun and the Unhumans, kind of similar premises of people getting. You didn't know who to trust because people are getting displaced with body doubles, one of them being robots and the Unhumans, and the other ones being the sea kelp people that were spreading fog of the planets that they could take over. So a lot of these in the book is kind of sectioned, but in the first half or two thirds of the book would definitely have just loaded with kind of these sci-fi strips that they really invoke a kind of 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
DC sci-fi adventure, the type of stories you'd see in Strange Adventures or Mystery in Space.
Yep, yep.
And so it really, I love that era of DC, and I especially love those sci-fi stories, even the sci-fi kind of based superhero stories that you'd have in DC in the 60s. So this was like uncovering kind of lost adventures from a Mystery in Space or Strange Adventure. So some were super cheesy, but it was really fun and enjoyable to read those types of strips in here when I get such a kick out of that. That era and that genre that they certainly, I think they nailed in trying to ape if that's what they were going for.
Yeah. There was an editor for this book, of course. His name is Bill McIntyre. I'm not familiar with him, but I have to wonder, was he coordinating some of these strips about, well, some of these are a little similar to what we're already doing, or was the sheer workload just probably like, ah, fine. You know, he didn't have time to sit there and say, well, you know, the Unhumans is a little kind of like this thing, you know, Stellar Apes is a little like Planet of the, like, he didn't have time for that. He was just like, just get it done, guys. We gotta crank this out. After that, we get some advertising. There's the secret message, which is just basically a maze that you do. There's an ad for the Whammo Kid, which I think I remember seeing in actual comic books, because it's an ad for the wheelie bar, the Whammo wheelie bar that you would put on your bike. So then there's, again, like I said, there's just like Whammo kept the advertising to the advertising as opposed to sticking it in the strips. Next up is The Edge of Time, which is set in 2068, about the Earth finding a way to escape an upcoming ecological disaster filled with spaceships, robots, and the villainous Captain Blood. Art by Sururi Guman. Then you've got a humor strip, Goody Bumpkin, which is kind of a fantasy humor strip by, again, Wally Wood. And now Goody Bumpkin has appeared in other places. I remember I've seen Goody, or at least seen referred to Goody Bumpkin in other strips or other comics. And so this must be the kind of thing where Wally Wood owned Goody Bumpkin, and he could do it in Whammo, but he obviously owned it because he could take it on and move it. It's the only character I can think of that I've seen in other places than Whammo.
Yep.
So then there's some informational stuff. There's a little thing on like the history of bread, the history of money. It's this kind of informational things that you used to see in the aforementioned 50s DC comics, like where they had those one page to fill in between stories. And it'd be like, oh, the history of this, the history of that. It's like informational kind of stuff.
On this page, you know, you have all these kind of humor gags and stuff too.
Mm-hmm. There's one panel things look like they're taken right out of a newspaper.
Yeah. So there's the door talk section there where you have the, whatever it is, 10 yellow doors. Does yours have a very amateur looking blue car with a guy with an eye patch above it?
Yes.
Okay. That thing is so amateur looking. I thought,
that does look like
the previous owner must have drawn this in there.
Yeah. So, that does look like it was drawn by a 5-year-old. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought for sure. It's okay. No, that was actually printed in it. All right.
And you got a lot of space to fill, man. We don't have time. Not everything could be Wally Wood. So then we've got Captain Valoran, which is a secret agent, secret agent adventurer type thing. He takes on a weird Jabba the Hutt villain named the Toad, art by Marvin Stevens. We've got The Wooden Sword, an adventure strip set in ancient Rome by George Wilhelms. The Diary of Ty Lock, yet another group of alien battling spacemen by Warren Tufts. Now, Warren Tufts I'm familiar with. I can't read off his credits. I can't think of them at the moment, but I'm familiar. I've seen that name in other comics and stuff. So he's another name. I mean, obviously, all these people probably were established to one extent or the other, but at least Warren Tufts was someone I was familiar with. And it's a pretty handsome looking strip. Did any of these pop to you?
Yeah, I really like this one. This one, right up there with like the Radian and the Tor and the Kaleidoscope of Fear. I think this was probably my fourth favorite one.
after that. It's another just great 50s, 60s space adventure sci-fi type thing that you can see on the DC. And the art is gorgeous, and you really use a great array of colors and everything. This is one of the best.
Yeah, I do love the colors. Yeah, very, very primary blue, yellow, orange. It looks more like what you would have seen in a newspaper. Yeah, it's a handsome strip. Below that is a half-page form that you can cut out and send in to WAMO, and you rank how you like the strips. it lists all the – not all of them, but it lists a lot of the strips, and then you can rate them boss, fair, or blah. So there you go. And if you send it in, you could be entered to win a giant box of WAMO toys. So I have to wonder how many kids did that. I don't know how many copies of this were sold, but I wonder how many of kids actually bothered doing it. And I wonder if any of those kids were awarded toys.
Yeah. Well, apparently not, because you flip the other side and you have the other half of that ad.
Yep.
A special subscription offer. The next 6 issues of WAMO Giant Comics mailed to you every 3 months for a year and a half. So, and yeah, in the indicia at the beginning, it said, number one and shipped quarterly. And so it's sad that this was the one and only issue. We could have had another 6 issues of this, Rob.
Can you imagine a letter carrier having to deliver this monster every 3 months to your house? Yeah, I mean, right. That was one of the hang-ups about subscribing to comics back in the day, was that they always came kind of beat up because the mail didn't treat them very well. And then I think even DC Marvel used to use that as a sales technique, saying mailed in a special mailer, like a durable mailer, because that way you comics wouldn't come beat up. But I can't imagine this making it through the post office grinder and not just be torn to shreds, because the dang thing, I mean, just the amount of money it would take to ship these out. Again, like I said about the form rating the strips, I wonder if any kid sent this in hoping to get 6 more issues of WAMO Comics.
Is yours fully intact, or is your coupon?
Mine is fully intact. Mine is fully intact. Yeah, I don't think a lot of kids wrote this. I think most of the people that got this comic got it after the fact, and they knew that it's already too late. So we missed our chance to subscribe to it. So after that is a strip called Super Sibling and the Magic Chokes, which is a chopper riding superhero, and it's by the cover artist VT Vincent. It has a very Hanna-Barbera kind of feel, like a speed buggy kind of thing, which is cute. There's Fugitive from a Scrap Pile, starring Clunker, the misfit monster. It's actually pretty cute, and it has a real kind of Rankin-Bass feel to it, I thought. And the artist is Willie Ito. I actually liked both of these quite a bit. I think they're really cute. What did you think?
Yeah, I like both of them too. And yeah, I think you nailed the two kind of analogs there. The kind of Hanna-Barbera teen adventure there with like a speed buggy or Scooby-Doo or Wacky Races type thing with Super Sibling. And then yeah, the Rankin and Bass, or I was going to think like a Dennis of the Menace or Harvey type.
Yep. There's definitely a Hank Ketchum in there. Yeah. Yep.
That they're trying to nail here with the Clunker the Misfit Monster.
So then there's another page of kind of just random gags and some educational panels about the history and things about the razor, the invention of the spectacles. Then we have another humor strip, Clyde, King of the Jungle, by someone named Sheehan. If you look really hard, you would think this is George of the Jungle.
Oh, I mean,
it looks just like George of the Jungle, which is not a bad thing.
No, I didn't look when George of the Jungle debuted, but man, this is like borderline like IP infringement here. the style and character design are like exact for that cartoon. So,
Clyde of the Jungle. I mean, totally. You can see it. Yeah, it's cute. Again, it's cute, but it's a complete ripoff of George of the Jungle. That's for sure. So then there's a one-page WAMO Fun Factory, which is a kind of Rube Goldberg sort of thing. And it's the idea that this is what the WAMO factory looks like. And it's all these workers, and they're creating different, like creating different products. And it's all, there's like air blaster department and the boomerang department. It reminds you a lot of, I don't know if you've ever seen it, that episode of The Simpsons where they go to New York. Did you ever see that one, Kyle?
Yep.
And they go and Bart and goes to the Mad offices, and it's like it's like a Mad magazine. Everybody looks like a Don Martin cartoon. That's kind of the gist here, which is cute. It's a nice way of like branding the company for kids. You're like, oh yeah, WAMO. It's a fun place to work. Yeah. So after that, there is a strip called Bridget and Newton by John Stanley, who created Little Lulu. And it looks kind of like a Peanuts Little Lulu kind of thing. And again, it's cute. It's a cute little strip.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't even look into who created this one. So that definitely makes sense. I was like, yeah, this reminds me a lot of Little Lulu or like Wendy the Good Witch or what. So definitely in the vein of that. So
next up is the one that breaks your brain. This is The Adventures of Melvin the Magician, about a little kid that dabs in black magic. I don't know the artist on it, but it features in one page 94 panels. It is almost it's unreadable. It is an unreadable. Why? I'm guessing they just thought, let's just shoot for the moon here, but it's useless as a comic book page because it's all looking at postage stamp size panels.
Yep. Well, they're down to the final pages here, and they're just going to crank something out here. But it was a nice Captain Caveman show up in this strip here. Yeah. Six or seven panels. So.
There is a lot of IP kind of similarities in a lot of these things. But yeah, I'm like, how long would it take you to do 94 panels? I mean, it's unreal. And then part of the other problem is because of this is of course, printed on newsprint, which is the lowest quality paper you can print on. The color registrations are all off a little bit too. So it makes it even harder to read because the color is all off by a little bit. So it's like, okay, I'm going to pass on Melvin the Magician. I don't think I read it. Even when I got this, I think I was like, yeah, I'm not going to kill my eyes doing this. Next up is Wild Earth Child, a humor strip where aliens meet their first earthling, a mod hippie, and hilarity ensues. Art by Dennis Ellefson. Again, it's cute. The art style's nice. Dennis Ellefson keeps the dialogue to a minimum, which is nice. It's a cute trip. It's sort of funny that it seems like most of the adventure stuff is in the front half, and then the second half is a lot more humor related kind of stuff. And then following that, there's a Helping Handsome, which is about a drag strip and racing cars by Nelson Dewey. And then Flabby and Gabby, a funny animal team. This page features 69 panels by Ward Kimball. Again, I don't know why Wham-O hates us. I don't understand.
Well, and the only reason it didn't break 100 is because the whole third, the bottom third is something else. Otherwise, if it would have been a full page like the Melvin the Magician, he probably would have broke 100 panels for the page.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. When you look at it like that, it looks like a film strip, like it looks like an animated film strip, that's how you would look at it, or like Filmation or something. And then on the inside back cover, there is this Flying Saucers Mystify the Air Force, featuring these paintings talking about, it's cute and all, but it doesn't really match the style of what's in the rest of the book. And it feels like this could have been something I would imagine you've seen from like a Time Life book, and they just repurposed it. Cause it doesn't, I'm betting this was not commissioned for Wham-O. This feels like something they had in the archives and they just stuck it on the inside back cover.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of makes, definitely sticks out just like the feature on the front cover, inside front cover there, the Fantastic Flying Machines. Yeah. It would be like something out of like a World of Science magazine or, something like that. But
it's more serious than it's kind of informational, even though it is about UFOs mystifying the Air Force, which again is really more of a statement than anything else. But that's it for Wham-O. I mean, that's the conclusion of it. I mean, all told, as a comic, did you read it all in one go? Did you kind of give yourself a break? How did you attack this thing?
I read most of the science fiction stories in one go. They kind of feed nicely into each other. Kind of capture that, DC Silver Age anthology, mystery in space type feel. So once I started reading those, I really got into those. I did take a break then and kind of tackled the humor sections, broken up, a couple pages each night for a week or so. Those get a little monotonous, but I could see, depending on what age group you fell in, if you had a couple kids, you handed this to your kids, where maybe your older kid would really be into the first half and your younger kids would be into the second half, and it'd be a little bit of something for everybody. So it's eight times regular cover price back in the day. So it would be a considerable investment, but it also, if you did have a kid read it from cover to cover, man, like that kid would disappear for a whole day. Good way to shut your kids up. So if this thing didn't cost me $40, I'd be
giving this to my son to shut him up this next week on spring break. So.
I mean, when I look back over this thing, I mean, obviously it's ill-conceived and flawed in its execution, but I got to give Wham-O credit that they were trying to do something different. I mean, everybody was getting into the Batman craze. Everybody. I mean, Archie, they did Archie superheroes. They did the monster superheroes. I mean, every sort of character was turned into like a Batman type thing because they wanted to get in on that action. And you know, Wham-O was doing it to sell some product, of course. But at the same time, like they did create something very unique. They didn't just put out a regular comic that was going to fight for newsstand space alongside Superman and Spider-Man. They were like, no, let's put the full force of the Wham-O Corporation into this. And obviously, Wham-O probably had a great relationship with a lot of department stores. And so therefore, they could get this comic displayed in department stores next to their other products as opposed to having again to fight alongside. I mean, you couldn't stack this on a newsstand anyway. It would just be too big. No newsstand vendor would have taken it. From what I understand, though, it must have been kind of a giant flop because, again, they never did another issue of it. And from what I have read and hear in different places, that basically most of these ended up in a warehouse somewhere. And indeed, my copy that I have has a price tag on it, like one of those, you know, like things that you get the little gun and you go, you know, on a can when you're discounting something. And this says Railroad Stores. I don't know what that means, but it says unit price, our price, 59 cents. So obviously Wham-O, you know, some store had overstock of this book and it got knocked down to some other probably local store who moved it for 59 cents. And whether it was ever sold at that point, I don't know. But I mean, there is some good stuff here. There really is. There's some fun. I mean, again, aside from what we already talked about, Ernie Colon, Lou Fine, and Wally Wood. I mean, these are big, you know, John Stanley. There's some real heavy hitters here. There are some fun things. The Clyde of the Jungle is fun, and The Fugitive from a Scrap Pile is fun, even Super Simple. Like, there's a lot of stuff here that I could see more being turned into animated cartoons more than a comic book, actually.
Yeah.
Super Something and the Magic Tokes, just, it, you know, like you could totally imagine that as a Hanna-Barbera show.
Yeah, well, even some of the more thrilling adventure strips, like the tour, and the Man from the Aeons, the Lou Fine one. I mean, that had almost like a Johnny Quest type feel to it, for sure. So you could see some of those Hanna-Barbera kind of adventure type cartoons that would have just been coming on the air kind of in the late 60s here. This was definitely in the vein of that. I love this thing. It is a huge... somewhat unyieldy package to take in. But with that, I mean, it's a great little time capsule of the era. I mean, you can see that the space race was definitely on people's minds. I mean, this came out 2 years before we landed on the moon. And really a nice encapsulation of what comics could be or what comics were at the time and all the genres. Curiously missing are Westerns. But you hit almost every other kind of comics genre. Yeah, like, you get the superhero.
Radian is close. I was about to say, there's no real superheroes. I mean, Radian kind of is, but there really is not a straightforward superhero.
Yeah, there was definitely more of the Julie Schwartz, you know, sci-fi hero fiefdom type thing that you would have had at DC, you know, like an Adam Strange type thing. So you get loads of sci-fi strips in here. You do have the one war strip, a ton of humor strips. You do have a couple adventure strips, kind of the sword and sandal type one that's really kind of captures what DC did in the early days of the Brave and the Bold strip, you know, before Justice League was introduced in 2008.
Right. Robin Hood, Shining Knight, or the Silent Knight, stuff like that.
Yeah, Viking Prince, one of my all-time favorites by your former instructor. And and then you get, a lot of these kind of Sunday funnies, which or single panel gags that were on some of the ad pages and stuff. They were a lot like a Bill Keane kind of Family Circus one and done single panel gag. You get a variety of artistic styles and line works, and despite the newsprint coloring not always being the great, you know, some of those strips actually do showcase some really nice color palettes. So it's a very wacky but diverse package that really kind of, I think, serves as a great time capsule of what was going on in comics in 1967.
Right. You could sort of see that they were, you know, trying to figure out what appealed to kids, and, you know, they were kind of going old school, but then you've got the introduction of, like, you know, like the hippies, you know, it's like the space explorers. You're like, well, all right, obviously they're familiar something a little bit with what's going on at the time. I am disappointed that there isn't one single page in this book that's devoted to one giant image, like just a poster. That would have been amazing to see. Like, you imagine if they had said to Wally Wood, hey, Wally, just do one full page of Radian smashing robots, and we're going to print it at full size. That would have been awesome to behold.
Yes, it would have.
It would have been a single comic book page at 14 by 22, but instead they went the other way and made it super small. And the other kind of curious choice I think they have is the problem with anthologies is, I think, and that's the case in books, comics, movies, TV shows, is that it's mentally exhausting to kind of keep setting your mind back to zero, as opposed to telling a story of A, B, and C through the whole thing. And, you know, DC Marvel, their anthology comics generally had three stories, maybe four if they were short, which you could tolerate. But this has what, like 40? And you really can't read it in one go, because it's just mentally taxing. Not that any of the material is, you know, mentally taxing, but just having to constantly start over with new premises every three pages. After a while, you just kind of get like, it sort of blurs out after a while, despite the unique styles and the different genres. It almost becomes a little samey, because there's just so much. It's like a buffet and you've eaten too much. And you're just like, oh my God, I can't take in anymore. And so it would have been interesting maybe if they had decided like half the amount of strips, but every strip is longer. You know, give Radian six pages as opposed to three, or the Adventures of Melvin the Magician. Tell the guy, you don't have to do 96 panels in a page. We'll give you three pages. You could do 30. But again, they were trying to hit everybody right off the bat, and obviously didn't totally work, because this is the only copy that ever exists. It's the only issue of Wham-O Comics that ever existed.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And the kind of to add to that exhaustion, I mean, we talked about some kind of reoccurring beats or story themes as well. But because these are all new features and the first time we're meeting any of these characters, each one of these, and this would fall more on the editor versus the individual strip makers, but each one of these falls into that give me your origin story, because we got to be introduced to these characters.
Right.
So that just kind of adds the exhaustion where compared to – see, I really like anthology comics. My favorite anthology of all time is Dark Horse Presents, and we'll actually have an episode covering that first issue dropping here shortly. But one of the unique things they did with that, which is a vast improvement over how this story is set up, is that first issue, you know, you're introduced to four different new characters or new features, but neither one of them is a straightforward origin. It's more you get kind of dropped into act two of those characters and just have to catch up instead of getting hit over the head with four origin stories. Whereas in this one, we got hit over the head with 40 origin stories here. So yeah, definitely could get monotonous on that end. So
I think it's safe to call Wham-O Comics like a noble failure. I mean, obviously it's a failure in that it didn't succeed. Wham-O didn't get into the comic business. They went right back to, you know, Frisbees and other related stuff. This was their sole shot at comic, but they tried. They gave it the old college try. I mean, man, I wish more comics had been published with accompanying TV ad campaigns. You know, I mean, that was long before my time, but I'm old enough to remember, I'm sure you are too, Kyle, that when like Marvel put out the G.I. Joe comic in the early 80s, it came with a TV campaign and they were advertising the comic. And I was like, I remember seeing those commercials being like, wow, it's like you never saw a comic book advertised on television. And it's like, that was really cool. That made it really special. So Wham-O tried. It didn't succeed, but not for lack of trying. Again, you're having Wally Wood, Lou Fine, John Stanley. They gave it a shot.
The G.I. Joe comic came out 5 years before I was born, Ralph.
Oh, no. I'm so old. Okay.
Yeah. No, but those were some of the first comics I ever read. My dad's youngest brother had a mail subscription to all the G.I. Joe comics, so I inherited, 80 G.I. Joe comics when I was a kid. So I ripped through those things. I do wonder about the distribution or lack of distribution on this, if that was potentially some of the roadblock as well.
Yeah.
You know, Wham-O, I believe they were a California-based company, whereas most of the comic publishers at the time would have been based out of New York.
Yep.
And they were, you know, still a fairly young company at that point. I think they started in the late 40s, like 1948 or so. So this was before they were even 20 years old. And so I wonder if there were some route to market issues that they didn't potentially have a handle on that could have led to spotty or total lack of distribution, where all these sat in a warehouse and that killed it.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, sort of summing up, I'm a bit of a stickler when it comes to treasury size. I hate to be pedantic about it, but like, I kind of don't like that Marvel has those treasuries that they put out now, and they're like, they're not wide. They're not the same width as treasury editions. Like the Silver Surfer Black is a full, like, couple inches narrower than the rest of the trade. Because to me, it's like, to me, the treasury format is 10 by 13. That's 10 by 5 by 13. That's treasury format. Anything bigger or smaller is something else. And I make some very, you know, as the authority on Treasury Comics, obviously, the ruling body on Treasury Comics, obviously what I say goes, but I make some dispensations here and there, for some things. I mean, I did cover Silver Surfer Black, and there's been some other books that are not quite treasury size, that they're close, but for generally, I say if it's not 10 and a half by 13, it's not a treasury. I do make exception for Wham-O, because obviously Wham-O was trying, and again, this is before DC and Marvel were doing treasuries, obviously Wham-O was trying the same idea of, let's make something impressive. And the way you make it impressive is you make it big. So while luckily this format did not take off, because could you imagine trying to collect tons of these things? It would be maddening. I do consider this like an honorary treasury, because it's the spirit of it, which is huge, you know, just big panels, fun for kids to read. In fact, in that the ad, which again you'll see on the website, the subscription ad, there's a drawing of three kids reading the comic at the same time. And could have done, because it's that big.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, what drives me crazy is Marvel's not even consistent with the sizes they put out. I mean,
no, it's all over the
Black is super narrow, and then, you know, the grand design ones they have are much closer to the traditional design and the history of the Marvel Universe traditional side. So even if you're buying all the new treasuries, they're not even a consistent format, and that drives me nuts.
Yeah, the collector in me is like, why are you doing that? Just make it all the same size. Like, come on. Well, I mean, Kyle, thank you so much for coming back on. This was great to talk to you again. And thank you for recommending this. No one in all the times, all the episodes of Treasury Guests I've done, no one has ever suggested talking Wham-O comics. And I thought I was like the only person that had it. And so when you suggested it, I was like, oh, this is great, because this is a unique item that probably a lot of people don't even know about. So thank you so much for coming back and talking Wham-O with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
All right. Well, you can go to my show headquarters at kingsizecomicsgiantsizefun.blogspot.com. Otherwise, you can just search for KSCGSF on Apple Podcast or Stitcher Radio. Very sporadically put up episodes where I'll drop like three in a single day, and then I'll go like 3 weeks without seeing anything else.
It's always good to make it hard for the people to listen to your show.
That's right. You just subscribe and it'll show up. I've been doing some retro review episodes recently where I pull out old blog posts from like 2011 through 2013, kind of read those as they were, because I'm really lazy. And then I add some 2021 commentary, and kind of if I've revisited that material or kind of where my headspace was at, and reevaluate those. And then I do hear launching, hopefully by the time this is this episode's out, there'll be a couple episodes out of my Dark Horse Presents podcast, where I'll be looking at the Dark Horse Presents anthology series, but also just looking at their story arcs or random one-off issues that Dark Horse is published over the last 35 years. So a lot of Star Wars content and stuff like that will be up as well. So if Dark Horse Comics are your thing, that is the show for you.
Outstanding. All right, everybody, you heard the man. You can go and follow those shows over on Kyle's website. And of course, here we want you to stay tuned. Well, thank you for listening, but we want you to stay tuned. I'm going to play some podcast promos. When I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Howdy, Nicholas Prom here. I want to tell you all about my new show, Captain Freakout Psychedelic Radio. It's a weekly block of mind-altering music from the 60s, 70s, and beyond. Tune in, turn on, and freak out wherever groovy podcasts are consumed. That's Captain Freakout's Psychedelic Radio, available on all podcasting platforms.
Between the golden age of Atlantis and the rise of recorded history, there were ages undreamed of. Hither came heroes and villains possessing swords and magic, whose deeds became tales and legends. I have come to relate these sagas. Let me tell you of the days of high adventure. Days of High Adventure, a new podcast discussing a variety of comics that fall into the fantasy or sword and sorcery genre. Available on most podcast services and Anchor FM.
And we're back with listener feedback, and this is going to be the comments we got for the previous episode of Treasury Cast, number 55, which was the Superman and Spider-Man team-up from Marvel Treasury Edition, number 28, with my guests John and Maggie Schaefer-Hames. So let's get right to them. First up is Ado Bosnar, who says, it always brightens my day a bit when I see that a new Treasury Cast has dropped, and boy, did I need a mood lifter today. Had to deal with some heavy real-life stuff. Sorry, Ado. It's also an extra bonus when you cover a book that I either have or had, in this case, back in the day, at the mass market paperback edition you mentioned. At the time, I don't even think I ever saw the Treasury size book on sale anywhere. The smaller format was not a deal breaker for me anyway, so she's probably already aware how much I love the digest and still do. All that said, I wouldn't mind rereading this story again since it's literally been decades in a bigger format. If not Treasury, then at least in normal comic size. As to the story, I remember liking it well enough, although apparently not as much as many other comics fans based on commentary about it I've read online over the years. The art is naturally damn good, and I'm surprised that there were so many inkers who contributed. Like you guys noted, I think it has a very consistent look throughout. Maggie and John, by the way, were great guests. I think that they should definitely return to Treasury Cast. First off, Ado, I'm sorry that this is probably not a book that you're familiar with. Well, I hope you enjoyed the episode anyway. And yes, I agree. Maggie and John should come back to Treasury Cast. Hopefully, we'll get them back someday. Robert J. Smith follows up. He says, I also had the paperback version of this book and didn't know that it had been at Treasury. So all this time, I've been waiting for this to be covered on Digest Cast. That's going to be a recurring motif throughout the commentary here, is that a lot of people seem to have the paperback and they didn't even know it was a Treasury, which is amazing. It's kind of weird that in the paperback, which I don't own the paperback, so I've never seen it, that they didn't feature an ad for the Treasury. Maybe the paperback came out later and the Treasury had already come and gone, but it seems weird that you wouldn't promote the book in another format. Like, you liked it in this format, maybe buy it in this other format. I don't know. Paul Wildenberger says, let me add myself to the list of people with the paperback version. I just pulled my copy off the bookshelf to compare it with the scanned pages in the gallery. Due to the aspect ratio, it appears many pages were split up. In the Treasury, there might be five panels on a page. The paperback puts two on one page and three on the next, with the word balloons rearranged to fit. For big splash pages, the artwork is cropped for space as well. Like Robert mentioned above, I never realized that there was a Treasury edition, much less what I was missing art-wise. The same goes for my paperback copy of Batman versus the Incredible Hulk. Again, so weird that they didn't advertise it in the paperback that you could buy the Treasury. Chris Franklin, of course, from our network, says, great, fun discussion. Cindy and I are about as geeky as they come, but I have to bow to John and Maggie for skipping part of their wedding to go buy a Treasury comic. That's commitment. Full disclosure, I was too young to get the original Supes versus Spidey Treasury off the stands, but I saw the house ads for this one, and I was really jazzed about it. I was thrilled to find a copy at our town's Bagley drugstore. I flipped through it, ready to go beg my mom for it, and then I saw that Hulk power ad. After nearly peeing my pants, I put the book down and walked away. I watched the Hulk on every week on TV, but that giant image of a furiously monstrous Hulk was just too much for my young weenie brain to deal with. So I had to wait until the DC Marvel crossover classics trade paperback to read this one. It is very Marvel, and you were all right. This is a very great preview of what had been if Warner Brothers had sold the DC rights to Marvel. Oh, and John Buscema drew that Just Imagine Stan Lee Creating Superman comic in 2001, but that wasn't the real Superman, so it doesn't count. Although a few years prior to this, Jeanette Kahn almost lured Buscema away from Marvel right before the DC Explosion Implosion, as detailed in the wonderful comic Implosion book from Tomorrow's. Yeah, I never read the Just Imagine books, Chris, and I think I remember that Buscema drew it, but my mind just blanked. But yeah, this is, again, this is our one shot at the big John Buscema drawing Superman. Mike Dinah says, I'm only here to second the demand for the Madbury Dr. Doom casting. Father! Jonathan hit gold. Maggie and John were great guests, and I really enjoyed this episode. Well done, everyone. Keep up the great work. Thank you, Mike. Rob McCarthy has a few comments. He says, I have so many thoughts. One, as a Superman Spider-Man team up, it's flawless. Two, the Hulk Superman fight made me mad because it wasn't as good as the totally fake Superman versus Hulk comic my brother sent me looking for. Oh, that's cruel. The Wonder Woman jump started my puberty. Do you desire this woman, Parasite? As an older reader, I've grown to love how the early intercompany crossovers just said, oh, screw it, it's all the same universe. Me too, Rob. I appreciate that. They didn't waste time with, like, Spider-Man hopping dimensions. It was just, look, this is just the DC Marvel universe. And then finally, Martin Gray from the Two Dangers for a Girl blog says, I've only reached this in a trade, but it's great stuff. Nothing will compare with that first team up in terms of impact. The first non-Oz DC Marvel book, but this is a terrific story. Yeah, true enough, Martin. I mean, nothing will ever replace the first Superman-Spider-Man team-up book, which we have to get to on Treasure Cast at some point. So that's going to do it for this episode of Treasure Cast. Big thanks to Kyle Benning for coming by and talking about Whammo Comics. It was really fun. I will put this book back in between my two bookshelves, and I will probably not touch it again until we eventually move out of this place, whenever that is. But it was great fun revisiting it, and I can't say that it's worth going to eBay and dropping $40 as Kyle did to get it, because it's just not a great read. But if you are a fan of comics history and you like weird little one-off projects, if you can pick it up for a reasonable price, it might be worth it. But again, I can't imagine what the shipping costs have got to be for Wham! Giant Comics. So anyway, again, that's going to do it. Thanks everybody for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of this show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Treasury Cast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. We're always talking treasuries over on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So again, if you want to support Treasury Cast, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. That's going to do it. Thanks everybody for listening. We will see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
It's a giant. A giant Whammo comic book with pages and pages of adventures. And pages of science fiction. And lots of pages of fun and laughter. You'll love the new giant Whammo comic book with its exciting new colors and stories by the top comic writers of America. Now under a dollar at toy stores everywhere. It's more fun from Whammo!